Welcome to this series of discussions of a fascinating and revealing part of medieval legal history, brought to you by members of the European Research Council project, Civil Law, Common Law, Customary Law, Consonance, Divergence, and Transformation in Western Europe from the late 11th to the 13th centuries. The aim of the project and these recordings is to break down the tradition of examining legal development in different countries and systems in isolation rather than comparatively. We hope the discussions will be of general interest and helpful to anyone who is teaching or studying medieval law. We have chosen litigation concerning dispossession as our subject for several reasons. Dispossession was a phenomenon of obvious social importance and concern. Its legal treatment is also a subject that's highly revealing of elementary legal ideas. For example, what is the nature of possession? Is it a fact or some sort of right? Can actions concerning dispossession be classified as criminal or civil? We therefore have the interplay of ideas, practice, and wider setting, which we see as crucial to the development of law in this period. We'll look at some of the main historiographical traditions on the subject, and then explore situations that led to litigation, how cases were brought and then decided, and finally the wider conclusions that can be drawn from these explorations. We're going to start, though, with an introductory discussion of core issues. Our discussants are Professor Emanuele Conte of the University of Roma Tre and Professor John Hudson of the University of St. Andrews. First, Emanuele, would you tell us about the categories in Roman law concerning property and possession?
In classical Roman law, possession was the material control of things protected by the praetor in order to first acquire property through lapse of time, through usucapio, and second, protect a factual ownership without the need of proving the property. Roman possession is not a right like property, and therefore it cannot produce an action. It is protected by praetorian interdicta because it is a fact qualified by law. In order to be qualified as possessor, you have to fulfill some legal requirements. You must hold in good faith a material object, not a right rising from an obligation, not a social status. Keep in mind that this legal qualification of a fact is a distinctive feature of Roman law. A Roman judge could rely on the law to distinguish the figure of a possessor from any other person holding something in different capacities. The tenant by lease, for example, was not a possessor because he did not hold the thing as if it was his own.
And can you tell us about any changes that occurred?
The change in the legal categories is connected with three major historical developments. First, the concentration of property in few hands and the subsequent diffusion of different forms of lease. Second, the weakening of the system of public justice replaced by a system based on protection. Third, the simple exercise of powers over things or persons was considered as a manifestation of a concession made by a superior, as the bishop or the king, and protected as such, as we'll go on to hear about when examining customary law. Rather than referring to the classical possessio, both the ecclesiastical and the secular courts preferred to develop the idea of vestitura, meaning that someone can own something or exercise some public power because he had been dressed by a superior. The vestitura is clearly connected with a customary seizing or gevere and the ecclesiastical procedure called exceptio spoli, which we will discuss in a minute. Once the Roman notion of possessions had been rediscovered in the texts of Justinian, the medieval vestitura tended to be merged with the Roman possession, so that it could reflect a form of property belonging to a lessee. This form of property was called dominium utile, by Pilius de Medicina, a law professor who taught in Modena since 1180.
And John, how does this work in customary law? By customary law, we're talking about the sort of law that's functioning throughout Europe up till about 1100.
The central notion in customary law has variously been termed guerrera or seizin. This might loosely be defined as land or another possession to which you have a justifiable title. Such title could be gained in various ways. It might be by conquest. One thinks of contemporary descriptions of Viking armies taking land and dividing it out between themselves. Or it might be land newly established for agricultural purposes, for example, cleared from forest. Or it might be land inherited or land purchased. Or it could be land that you have received by a gift or grant. The verb seis indicates land or another right being transferred to someone, normally by gift or grant. Such a transfer might establish lordship over the person or over the land or over both. There's no clear sign of a conceptual division mirroring that between possession and property. Rather, the strength of claim to be entitled might be based on the length of time within which you or your family had had the land, or upon the validity of any transfer.
And is this something that we can compare with the dispossession in Roman law?
We must be careful about comparing what are casually called Roman legal institutions with other systems. Roman law changed very substantially during antiquity. When Roman legal texts from different ages were gathered together in the early 6th century by Justinian, then this huge compilation was almost completely laid aside for 5 centuries in Western Europe to be revived in the 12th century. At that time, introducing the old idea of Roman possessio was a radical innovation for practice. The courts began to offer protection only to possessors in the sense of that term in Roman law as they read it in Justinian. For example, if the plaintiff was not ready to prove his good faith, or if the object he claimed for was not a real thing but a personal right, the judge could deny him the use of a possessory procedure. This forced him to prove his subjective right, that is, his legally recognized claim to, for example, land, and not only the simple objective fact of having enjoyed the use of something in good faith. To prove his subjective right, the plaintiff needed to submit evidence of purchase or inheritance, what was sometimes very difficult.
And does this work similarly in canon law as well?
The most significant focus in canon law, in church law, was often on cases where the bishop had been deprived of his land or of his office, probably by a lay power, in the context of a wider dispute. The bishop might then put forward what was called the exceptio spolii. An exceptio being an argument put forward in court, sometimes, as in this instance, as to why a case should not proceed. So the bishop's argument, his exception, is that he should not answer on any other matter while he is despoiled. The aim was to get his property restored to him, or his office restored to him before any litigation progressed further.
And Emanuela, could you tell us a little bit about Lombard law, a law which developed in North Italy in the early Middle Ages and continued to be of importance in our period?
Lombard law was closer to canon law than you might expect. Also, at Lombard law, there was no legal qualification of a factual situation comparable to Roman possession. As for the exceptio spolii, Lombard law, too, focused on procedure. The simple fact of behaving as an owner of land or a master of serfs for a certain time could block the lawsuit of anyone claiming property or liberty. Likewise, a serf behaving as a free man for a certain length of time was secured against any lawsuit by his former master.
And what other ways are there of dealing with dispossession?
Outside the context of Roman law and canon law and Lombard law, quite possibly the most common way of dealing with dispossession was to exercise self-help, that is, to seize back the land oneself. Some possibility of exercising self-help in a constricted fashion would remain present throughout our period and beyond. Alternatively, one might seek aid from a more powerful figure to help get back what you saw as your own, including, if you're a monastery or church, seeking God's help through prayer. One might also look to a superior authority in another way, by bringing a complaint to that authority. How far one was complaining of a wrong one had suffered, how far one was claiming a piece of property, is hard to tell. Most likely the two forms of complaint were not distinct. Claims about recent dispossession need not have been conceptually or procedurally very different from any other attempt to gain land or other rights to which one felt oneself entitled.
We're going to look a bit later at documents that are involved in some of the cases that we have for possessory litigation, but are there any documents like this in this early period as well?
One text to which I would like to draw attention appears in a formulary, probably of a late 7th century, the Formulary of Markov. A formulary is a set of texts which can be used in various situations, sometimes showing influence from more learned traditions, such as that deriving from Roman law. This example is a letter from a king to a count, saying that one of the king's faithful followers had come to him and stated that one of the people in the count's area of control had taken, by force from the king's follower, a possession and was retaining it unjustly, and that the follower couldn't get justice from him. The king ordered the count to constrain the alleged perpetrator of dispossession, if it had actually been a dispossession, that he make good the case according to the laws. If the man was unwilling to do so, and the matter was not properly settled in the count's presence, the count was to take pledges to take guarantees from the man and send him to the king's presence on a set date. Now, how widely such a process was used, even at the time the formulary was written, is uncertain. But it does show one way in which such cases might be treated, and such complaints to authority will be central to our discussions.
So, we see the combination of ideas and of procedures and practices, which will be our concern in the following episodes. Next, though, we're going to look at the historiographical issues regarding dispossession from the perspectives of Roman law, common law, canon law, and customary law.